Hey, everybody, this is John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. For co-directors Daniel Schmidt and Gabriel Abrantes, the making of Diamantino was just as, if not more complex, than the award-winning film's insane plot. It tells the story of Diamantino, the world's premier soccer star, who loses his special touch and ends his career in disgrace. Searching for a new purpose, the international icon sets on a delirious odyssey where he confronts neo-fascism, the refugee crisis, genetic modification, and the hunt for the source of genius. That's a whole lot of ground to cover within the confines of an hour and a half, and after seeing the first assembly of their cut, the duo was dismayed and ready to throw in the towel. Even during production, Schmidt felt as if they had bit off a little more than they could chew. Unhappy, they walked away from their project and decided to regroup at a later date. Ultimately, they came to realize that they still had a fair amount of interesting material they felt they could work with, and that their failures could, through the magic of post-production, be turned into an avant-garde tour de force. Using stock imagery, frenetic archival footage, and green screen wizardry, they spliced together a cut worthy of Cannes, New York Film Festival, the Toronto International Film Festival, and more. I sat down with Schmidt prior to Diamantino's screening at TIFF, and we talked about adapting to difficult circumstances, learning from mistakes, and never giving up hope on your vision. Enjoy. Hey, everybody. This is John Fusco, and I'm here with Daniel Schmidt of Diamantino, which is a crazy feature that's playing here at TIFF this year. And it was at Cannes earlier this year, and you guys took home a couple awards from Cannes. What awards were those?
We got, like, the second prize for the best puppy, best dog, which is called, like, the...
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah.
The bark?
Palm dog, I think.
Palm, yeah.
So we got the Grand Prix for that. And then we got the top prize for the section that we were in, which is Critics Week, which was a huge surprise and
that's
big
awesome.
Honor. And, yeah.
How? What are you, in what section are you here at TIFF?
We're in a section called Midnight Madness, which is a sort of, they show the movies at midnight to a very, like, lively audience. I just went to a screening of another film in the section last night, and people are, like, applauding at the ads,
yeah.
And they're sort of, like, they've got, like, it's a really, it's really kind of vital and crazy. So I'm kind of nervous to do that, but I think it's mostly themed towards, like, genre films and maybe a sort of expanded notion of what that could be, or certainly with our film. I feel like it's like our film, Predator, Halloween.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Climax.
Yeah, I don't know how we fit in, but
I do. I think there's a certain, like, level of cult status that comes along with these pictures, and your film is certainly unique. And as is, I guess, your situation as a filmmaker. You're an American by birth, right? But you're making very European films, it seems. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about, like, how you got to this point in your career where you're living in Lisbon, right? You're in Portugal, or is that your co-director?
Yeah, so my co-director is a little bit less of an imposter. He's actually half American, half, or he's, you know, he's a dual national citizen or whatever, of Portugal and of America. He spent most of his upbringing in America, and he's a very, I think that one of the first things that sort of brought us together as collaborators, we've been working together on and off for the past almost 9 years or something like that,
wow.
Was a sort of appetite for playing with, like, a Hollywood imagery and sort of investigating that. And so he's very much coming from a sort of American perspective and upbringing in Hollywood cinema, and myself as well. But of course, you know, our appetites took us to a broader or somewhat broader view to look at other world cinema. And when we started making projects, even our very first project was filmed in Brazil. We've done films together and separately, like in Angola, Sri Lanka, China, Puerto Rico. And I think we're sort of drawn to seeing how, certainly how these local cultures and how local cinema is also interrelate with like the Hollywood sort of system in this sort of post-global age. So that interest in globalism and in transnationality, but in regards with image making and with movie making, has sort of set us off on this tangent where we've been making films in different places. And then I think another aspect, which is can't go unmentioned, is the financing opportunities. And again, because we are so interested in playing with and subverting and sort of immersing audiences in these the language of Hollywood cinema, to do so in America, what better place to make Hollywood movies than in Hollywood? But I don't think we have the talent or the know-how to crack into that system, or the patience or whatever. And so we started looking for other forms of financing and doing stuff, whether it's through gallery financing or sort of unconventional financing structures has been important to us. But the European model and the rest of the world offers, or can offer sometimes, they have a sort of socialized cinema where you compete for government grants, and a bureaucracy grants you the finances to make a film. And this is really the first film that we've done in that way, maybe the last film that they'll let us do this way. But that I think practicality of following the money is part of it. Yeah.
So what was that experience like competing for this grant? Like, what did you have to, present to the government in order to win them over?
I think with a lot of these things, you basically just present a script and your own sort of CV, and then you have to partner up with a producer who's sort of like going to be the person who, is the producer, is dealing with, is ultimately financially responsible. So we ended up pairing up with an established producer in Portugal, and then did similarly in France and Brazil, this sort of co-production structure of trying to, again, you're never getting to a Hollywood budget, not even a low budget Hollywood film, but you're able to like at least get a little bit more money than to just make a movie in the cafe or whatever. I think it varies country by country. In France, it's very, the French cinema economy is very healthy from at least a certain perspective. And I think that it's also very competitive, and they really, really review the scripts very, very carefully. And I think they turned us down two or three times or something like that. Whereas in Portugal, and I've heard things are shifting, but Portugal, which seems to be going through somewhat of a renaissance, though I think it's always been kind of like the vanguard of like pretty interesting cinema, it seems like the bureaucrats, and that's what they are, they might be bureaucrats that have some sort of literacy in cinema, are more open to being like, well, let's try a risky project. So when we sent in the script, 4 months later, we got back notes from them. And the CNC in France sent us back notes, and they're like, no, you need to fix this. This is bad. Why are you doing this? It seems weird. Like, I can't remember what it was, but it was a lengthy, like, pan of our piece, which we probably deserved. And the Portuguese funding body just sent us back like two sentences. The first sentence was like, pro, seems like a, brilliant new idea, wow, ravishing, something overly complimentary like that. And then the second sentence was like, this film seems like it's not something you'll be able to realize. It seems like a nightmare that you're pursuing on your own or something. But I think at least the latter was true.
But then how did you convince them that it was something that you could make? Because it is a film that has so many different ideas and so many different styles, I think, to it. It's mm-hmm. just crazy. Like, how do you neatly package a film with so many themes, in a way that you yourself can make sense of it, even while you're directing it, if that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure for the element of convincing the funding bodies. I'm not really totally sure, and I think that it's a bit of the role of the producer, but also looking back at our previous work, we had often been working with what was clearly incredibly anemic budgets to make things that were somewhat sort of spectacular and, I mean, in the sort of most basic version of that word, like that there's spectacle, that right. there's this sort of like Hollywood imagery. So I think that we were able to convince people a little bit on the basis of that, and they look at awards and these other types of things. But then for ourselves, I think it really, the film only became something that was somewhat cogent and somewhat concise and watchable through, probably most filmmakers deal with this, but through a series of revisions and reorientations to the subjects as we went along. A lot of the previous films that we've done, we would shoot a little bit. We shoot mostly on film, shoot a little bit, then go home and think for 3 months, and then, you know, you're kind of quote-unquote stuck with the footage that you shot. You've spent some film, you spent some people's time, you spent some money. And so then we would try to basically go and do, like, reshoots. But we would do that 3 times, and that was, like, the way we just made movies. And with this one, they kind of threw us into the... We were dealing with a little bit of a bigger crew and with a more conventional production structure. They kind of just threw us in there, like, you're shooting for 5 weeks straight. Yeah. We had never done this before. Yeah. The shoot was a fiasco. It was bad. The script was there, and the final script that you see, or the final whatever the story that you see in the film and most of the elements were already there, but being able to execute that on set, let's say, on location or whatever, was not something that we were up to the task of doing. So then when we got back, we looked at the footage, like a friend of ours had done an assembly edit, you know, so we could sort of take stock, and we wanted to, like, kill ourselves. It was just awful. It was awful, 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 awful. And I think we were thinking of just, like, okay, we'll... I don't even know what we were thinking, but... We ended up taking off 4 months to do other work and other things, and just put it away. And when we came back, we had to we had already sort of signed up to do some degree of post production, like the dogs and the soccer games are largely green screen, are largely composite. So we had already kind of like primed to go into this sort of stage of painting and sort of like. Bricolage
like
and assembly.
Spectacular a little bit, like you said, you know, like earlier when you were talking about how this is sort of based off spectacle, a lot of the VFX work that you did kind of brought that feeling, I felt.
For sure, yeah. And I think that basically, again, because we are idiots who are drawn to that kind of imagery, as soon as we started to get a little bit of that, like, going and bringing it to life on our editing computer screens, that gave us a little bit more momentum and excitement. But it also gave us the awareness of, I mean, you know, the phrase like fix it in post or whatever. It's like, well, we really were sort of like, we've got all this green screen imagery. We've got some time to rethink how we could use it, and we have this appetite for playing with stock imagery and other sorts of like secondary imagery that we could sort of buy or source from somewhere else. And so that helped us basically start to suture together like the, you know, sort of the broken pieces of what we had initially set out to film, but in a way that didn't feel, and hopefully doesn't feel to the audience, but didn't feel like false or some sort of band-aid. It's like using the stock imagery really, it's so, stock imagery constitutes in real life, so to speak, the kind of imagery that's used in these like Brexit ads or propaganda ads or in these medical infomercials or whatever. And so pulling in this kind of secondary imagery and buying it became a very like interesting and quite inspiring way to sort of both save the film but also ground it in a sort of image economy that is kind of the reality of the world that Demontino is living in.
Yeah. So why did you like decide to tell this story? There's, you know, as I said, there's a lot going on to it. One of your Demontino himself, or Demontino, is pretty reminiscent of a particular soccer player who we won't like name, but why was this the story that you guys felt that you really needed to tell at this present moment in time?
Sure. I mean, I think that dovetails with what we were just saying. But just in general, for all of Gabriel and I's films and our films apart, we've been pretty fixated on pop culture. Yeah. I mean, that's what drew us to the cinema in general in the first place, is this sort of like common art, the sort of base art, the most like popular art form. And so while we had been dealing with that kind of imagery for other sort of, I guess, sort of iconic stories throughout time, a lot of the films were sort of like trans-historical in nature, we were like, why don't we try to do something that's situated in the present? And what would be a way to sort of respond to this sort of overwhelming 24/7 like inundation of news and whatever you want to call it, buzzword, you know, like
social
just the
media,
social
so,
media,
yeah.
Like just the deluge of information, as useless or helpful as it might be. And we wanted to sort of, you know, work with a character or a human experience in that. So we thought, who would be at the center of that? Oh, it's probably a celebrity. Like, who is more often manipulated by all these different social pressures than a celebrity to sort of respond to? What do you think about this crisis? Or what do you think, you know, the whole world of Twitter, et cetera. So we were looking around at different references for that. And I think that we were also interested in newer forms of celebrity, and so the Kardashians sort of stood out as like, okay, that could be a possible reference, but they're a little hard to find the humanity there,
and I
this is just an aside, but I am so surprised that there has not been a big film about reality TV. I know there was like Garone made a film, and I watched some show called like, it was about like The Bachelor, like a fictional version of The Bachelor, but it's like, it's strange that someone hasn't made like a,
you know?
But so we were kind of going down that path, and we were like, I think we are not maybe literate enough in it. Like a lot of my friends, they just watch reality TV, and I was like, they should make that film.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not someone who can speak to that. Not that I know sports well either, but as we started to look around for other icons that could sort of be this weird intersection of all these different, cultural phenomenons, cultural pressures, and like a sort of distorting presence to those things, we came across two Foster Wallace texts, David Foster Wallace texts, one which is called Roger Federer as Religious Experience, which is speaks about, they're both about tennis, which Wallace was obsessed with, but and played. But the first one is about sports as basically being the last sort of bastion of technical skill by a human that sort of exceeds what we think humans can possibly do, and therefore gives the spectators of the sport a sort of transcendental experience, a religious experience.
Right.
That this used to be the sort of realm of artists who could make a statue or a painting that was so lifelike or so beautiful, but that now with the, you know, the turn of art to something that's more conceptual, and also with religion sort of waning, at least in certain parts of the world, that athletes really kind of are our last sort of demigods or whatever, and that they're, you know, they're, I think in the opening lines of the film, like, that their tennis court or their football field or soccer field or whatever you want to call it is the sort of new Dionysian stage or the new church or the new cathedral or whatever. So we had that text, and then another text by him, which is called How Tracy Austin Broke My Heart, which is about a tennis star who is like a prodigy that he was obsessed with and kind of like, I think, like had a crush on. She was like his peer. And he was always like, how is she so good? You know, at age 14, she's like a master or whatever they call the, you know, the great tennis greats. And she gets in a car accident, career ends, and she writes a tell-all. And he's like, I know this tell-all is going to be trashy, but I can't resist knowing like what made her a genius.
Yeah.
And he reads the book, and it's absolutely the most vapid, innocuous, like, there's no I in team. There's, you know, it's like, there's just nothing. There's no expression of genius or even an expression of humanity, really. Right. And so
I see.
He comes up with this thesis that, like, would afford some athletes their genius is a sort of like emptiness of the mind. So we grab from the two of those inspirations that could be somehow somewhere between those two would be the interesting germ for a character, and then that mixed with all of the other bullshit I was just talking about with celebrity culture and stuff. And then finally, as we were going back to the first question or whatever question it was about, you know, working in a European model, was okay, we want to talk about the rise of the right and the sort of Euro crisis going on right now. We also have financing from Portugal. So wait a minute, athlete, empty-headed, cultural icon, Portugal. Okay, we know what the movie is. And then we had this actor who Gabriel had worked with before, Carlo Ducato, who's just amazing. He's that I feel 100% about. And Miguel Gomez has worked with him as well. And he just, it all clicked,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were fortunate there.
He hit it. I'd like to ask, you know, you talk a little bit about your partner in directing. It seems like you do a lot of co-directing. Why is that? Like, what do you see is the value of having sort of two minds behind the camera over just like, because it seems a lot harder in a lot of ways, I think, to actually have two people sharing a vision than just one person in charge.
Sure. I think probably the first, like, you know, most honest answer is that it wasn't something that we had, you know, sort of calculated ahead of time. It was sort of, we're friends, let's try to do something. We didn't know that what we, I think the first one we made, I mean, I guess I should say I know the first one I made, but there's an aspect of kind of forgetting exactly the circumstances, was actually for like a performance festival, and it was just Gabriel and I, and we went to Brazil, and we had one other friend who had never made films and never even operated the camera before, operate the camera. And it was just sort of like a way to be together and try something new. I think we are often embracing a degree of amateurism. And then I think there's also an unconscious embrace of it where we just like didn't know that this is not the way you're supposed to do things. I mean, I had gone to cinema school, so it's like, I know, and you know, I'm not living under a rock. I know that most movies are directed by one person, but when you're kind of doing it for the first time, you're not really sort of attuned to that, like, oh, where's the third AD or whatever. I mean, there was just three of us, but like, you don't really know the hierarchy that has been really sort of well-oiled and put in place by the Hollywood hegemony. It's like, you're just not. So that first came from an unconscious place, but then I think as we developed, yes, we had developed a creative rapport, and I started working with another friend that we worked together in a different way, and they were really, really, I don't know, just beautiful experiences, and I think made the ideas better. But I think there was also maybe even in growing anxiety, at least on my part, of like, oh shit, man, I can't do this on my own. It became a sort of insecurity of like, well, I feel like with another person, we can encourage each other to take risks, or we can, you know, censor one another, critique one another in a way that, like, me just sitting in front of my computer or in front of two actors, I'm going to not have the same sort of confidence. I'm not going to have that person to, like, hold their hand and them to hold my hand back or whatever. I think that now that I've, you know, made a couple films, I better understand that a lot of directors develop really, I think, pretty intimate relationships with their producers or their actors or other people. And that's something that excites me and I would like to try to do. But for us, the surrogate was sort of each other and the co-directing thing.
It seems like it's nice to have like an immediate bouncing board there for you, like while you have to make these decisions.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's also just like the films that we make, we're often, again, making it with like insufficient budgets, and we are taking a lot of risks on different levels, whether it's like financially or in terms of how we're representing things. And I don't know, we're fragile people too, so we're like getting sick or we're like getting upset, and it's like, it's basically like almost an insurance measure that there's like two of us. Like if you sent like a ship into outer space to do some thing that you weren't sure how it was going to work, you'd probably send two people rather than one, or I don't know. So, but yes, it also can be a problem. I mean, with both of these guys, the other guy's name is Alex Carver, but we've just worked together really well, and I feel more and more fortunate the more and more I realize that that's, I guess, not often the case when directors work together. And I think working with like three directors all of a sudden, that would, to me, that strikes me as insane. So I get that people thinking that like two is weird. It's like, for me, I'm like, two is so natural,
three is weird.
Yeah. Three is weird.
It could be interesting,
but yeah, I don't know. There's
I guess I also just want to ask, you know, you have made these shorts, or you did make a lot of shorts internationally with, these same collaborators. How did making shorts inform you when it came time to make features?
Two of the films I made before are actually features, and two of them are shorts. Mm. Gabriel is the one who sort of did like 40 shorts in a row. Yeah. But I think especially actually even doing the features for me was useful, because it was just like, you kind of put them out there and we had some nice reception. Like for me, it was great to, I was happy with the way they turned out more or less, and to show it these, you know, nice festivals with receptive audiences, but ultimately they weren't reaching the public the way and communicating and maybe moving the public as much as this film. And so that, let's say if we could describe them as somewhat failures, the failures of that kind of made me feel okay to just like keep taking the risks, and then the small successes of those films gave me, you know, just as anyone who probably the normal answer for shorts is like, well, I found out I could do these three things well, and then I finally put them into the feature. But basically, we threw out a lot of the sort of the main sort of modus operandi that we had used for the previous shorts and features. Like we sort of almost started from scratch in a certain way, and that ended up, like I said, we with the previous films we were usually shooting a little bit, then taking a break, shooting a little bit, just as one thing that's a little bit unconventional but that served us. Doing the 5-week conventional feature shoot blindsided us, and then it basically became this sort of like, well, how do we reinvent in post? So for us, it was a very new process, and I don't know how much the previous films on a sort of like specific level helped or something.
Well, maybe it was just like having gone through those experiences, you know, like you said, and with like shorts and with your previous features, whatever failures or whatever things that even you were tired of doing at that point.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, you know, like let's try something new. Let's do this in a whole new weird way, which is, you know, like your movie is very unique, and it's evident that it's the result of a lot of like intense experimentation, I think.
Mm.
So I guess that, you know, just to wrap things up here, I'd like to ask you something I ask all my guests, and that's if you had any, like, golden nugget of advice for aspiring filmmakers, what would it be?
I mean, I guess it's something to the effect of, I don't know if this is just a series of platitudes, but it's like, for me, what got me out of sort of some dark holes is like to learn by doing, like just make the projects, don't sit around thinking about them. Just like, cinema is something that can be a very social experience, it can be a very hands-on experience. Go on location, work with quote-unquote real humans, like get messy, make mistakes, learn from the mistakes, but just like get out there and do it, rather than getting stuck in sort of like, I need to do the 10th version of my script or whatever. Like the script for Demontino, we wrote it in 4 weeks, 1 or 2 months before we started shooting, which caused a huge amount of problems. But I'm glad that we didn't spend, you know, years developing. And then I think the other thing that I taught a semester of cinema or filmmaking recently at Rutgers.
Okay, cool.
And was just, of course, everyone's entering into movies like probably from an early age, and then they're refining or they're sort of shaping their tastes as they get into whatever it is, high school or college. But I think things become more and more sort of niche, where people are like, I'm a documentary filmmaker, or I want to make movies that look like Wes Anderson, or I'm really like anti any sort of commercial thing. I want to do, you know, like these sort of kind of dogmatic ideas or fairly somewhat superficial delimitations of what cinema can be or what cinema can be to them. And for me, it was really great to speak to my students and sort of be like, let's look at the earliest cinema, like the, you know, the old, like, cinema of attractions, like Méliès and Edison and so on. Like, let's look at the train coming into the station and the waves hitting the shore, just like that early version of spectacle, even though, yes, those films are, I can agree, are kind of boring to watch or whatever, to think of how exciting that might have been. And let's look at memes and let's look at the Vine videos or whatever. It's like that the multifarious cultures of moving image are pretty vital, and they're pretty broad, and that if you're able to kind of reorient your perspective or open up your perspective to seeing how vast the possibilities of image making are, and also be aware of the problems of it, but like to see how vast they are, then in turn, if you are interested in being an image maker or working in that in those cultures, in those economies, you can kind of be like, well, there must be a somewhat commensurately vast amount of ways to make those images. And that sort of starts to free you up from being like, oh, I don't need to just like do the assignment with my four friends, or the first film I make out of college, I need to wait until I get the Sundance whatever thing. Yep. It's just like, there's so many ways to make a mistake, to try to make a mistake.
And to learn from it, too. So that's the best way to learn. Well, great, man. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today. And good luck with the rest of TIFF. I think have you even had a screening yet? Or
I think there was the some press screenings, but okay. We haven't done the public screenings yet.
Well, your midnight screening, good luck with it.
Thank you.
It's going to go over very well.
I'm knock on very wood. Nervous. yeah, we'll see how it goes.
All right, Daniel. Cool. Take it easy. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for listening. As always, if you like what you heard, please subscribe to the No Film School podcast on whatever platform you use. If that platform is iTunes, you can go ahead and give us a 5-star rating or whatever rating you want if you like us. And be sure to stay tuned for Indie Film Weekly every Thursday. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me on Twitter at Jim_John_Jim. You can follow No Film School at No Film School. And we'll see you on Thursday.